And so joining us now from his Portobello office is Tommy Shepherd, MP. Tommy has served as an MP for the Scottish National Party, representing Edinburgh East since 2015, and he's held a number of positions in the party, including as the SNP's shadow leader of the House of Commons. Tommy, welcome to Fresh Air Radio.
Good to be here, Ollie.
Thank you very much. It's very exciting because you're actually my MP, and obviously I assume the MP for many people listening, so it's great to be chatting with you.
I would have thought so, yeah. I got a lot of students in my constituency.
Absolutely. So if I may, I would like to start talking with you about Ukraine, because obviously that is the issue on everyone's mind, virtually in the world at the moment, including in Scotland here. As of this morning, the Home Office have issued just over 950 visas to Ukrainian refugees. And this is, of course, in the context of over 2 million people having fled Ukraine. What is your response to the current state of affairs on that front?
I think it's shocking, and I think this will come to haunt them, to be honest. I appreciate that the British government is doing important stuff in terms of its diplomatic effort, in terms of military hardware, in terms of other supplies. But when it comes to trying to assist people who are fleeing the conflict, they have been woefully inadequate. And this insistence on going through a visa route when people are literally running away from a life and death situation and need emergency response. It's just shockingly bureaucratic and is not necessary. I mean, the whole of the European Union, which Britain sadly has now left, but every other country in the European Union is effectively opening their borders and telling people they can come, not on an immigration visa. They're coming on what's called a temporary protection order, which just means they are given sanctuary and they're given space to try and get their lives back together. You know, we can worry about the paperwork afterwards. And the British government, you hear them in the House of Commons, they keep going on about, oh, well, we have to have checks and national security. Well, how come that doesn't affect anybody else then? I mean, what's so exceptional about the United Kingdom that it's going to be security undermined by allowing refugees to come here? It beggars belief, really. And, it's as if they must think that Putin's trying to, Putin's got some, deep agents or something that are going to be crossing the border with the refugees to try and infiltrate the British state. I mean, it's just madness.
Well, that is almost what Priti Patel is hinting at, that there is a potential it's like, security risk.
It's lunacy. I mean, it's just, it really doesn't stand up. And, all you need to do is just invite people to come in and, take their details when they get off the plane and contact them later. It's like a very lackadaisical, relaxed response to what is an emergency crisis situation. And like I say, I think they will pay a price for it. I also think they're out of sync with public opinion, even their own supporters, the Tories. I mean, I think there's an appetite amongst the public to open their arms and open their houses and try and help.
And is there any scope at all for the Scottish government being able to take a different direction on this? Or I imagine because it's kind of foreign and home policy.
Well, sadly not. I mean, we have, obviously we can talk about, the arguments for Scotland becoming an independent country, which is something clearly in the SNP, it's quite close to my heart. But over the years in Parliament, of course, we've argued short of Scotland becoming independent and having control of its immigration, we have argued for discretion to be offered to the Scottish government for circumstances just such as this. It also applied in the post-Brexit arrangements, for example, where either the aspirations or the needs of communities in Scotland are different from what they might be in southern England, and to have the flexibility within the devolution settlement to be able to respond to that, so that the Scottish government would have the opportunity to provide temporary documentation in circumstances just such as this. But every single tiny little bit of that we've tried to argue for has just been completely rejected. I mean, they won't even countenance it for a second, which is weird in many cases, because we Scottish government does have control over a lot of stuff, like the law on suicide and assisted dying, for example, the law on abortion, marriage, gay rights. We have a lot of quite significant stuff that affects people's lives, but not the ability to say who could live here even on a temporary basis.
Sure, sure. And this is obviously becoming a bit of a crisis for the government, this element of the story in particular. Do you think it's helpful or necessary to be calling for certain individuals in government to be resigning over this issue, or would you rather they focus their energy on, you know, keeping those people in place and getting a grip of the issue?
I haven't called anybody to resign over this issue. Yeah. I think Boris Johnson would do everybody a favour by getting out of the way, but that's for a whole range of other reasons not related to Ukraine. Do you know what I think? I think the truth of it is that this is actually an institutional problem. Certainly the current political leadership of the Home Office, Patel in particular, do reflect that and chime with it. But it's a deep-rooted problem, I think, within what is a very large, cumbersome bureaucracy as well. It doesn't surprise me. One of the main jobs that we do in terms of caseworkers, members of parliament, is helping people with immigration problems. And you know, you have to see the Home Office up close to believe just how out of date and old fashioned some of their attitudes and procedures are. I mean, I often think that if other countries treated us the same way that we treat people from other countries when they're trying to come here, we would be up in arms and outraged at the sheer lack of respect and decency that pervades that department. So I think we need and there's the whole thing about the hostile environment and the general 19, a department stuck in many ways in the 1950s. And so I think it needs a root and branch reform, the Home Office, to be honest.
Sure, and the humanitarian side is absolutely what's dominating headlines this week. But I would like to ask you about something that the First Minister, the SNP First Minister Nicola Sturgeon, said yesterday regarding NATO. She said that nobody, this is a quote, nobody wants to see an escalation of the conflict, but perhaps the only thing that nuclear weapons are deterring at the moment is the ability to properly and directly help Ukraine. She also said that NATO shouldn't rule out imposing a no-fly zone over Ukraine. Do you agree with her on those issues?
I would rule out a no-fly zone certainly at the moment. I mean, but clearly, if what she's saying is that circumstances change and we need to keep be on the ball, then obviously that's self-evident. But you know, there are consequences, and so it's not really a. The argument isn't about whether or not NATO should impose a no-fly zone. The argument is, do you want to see an escalation of the conflict and NATO forces, including British and Scottish forces, actively involved in the conflict? That's the question. Now, there are circumstances where the answer to that might be yes, but I wouldn't say that at the moment.
Yeah. On the issue of nuclear weapons, do you think she's right that the only thing nuclear weapons are deterring at the moment is the ability to properly and directly help Ukraine?
I don't think to be honest, I don't think nuclear weapons are a deterrent anyway. I've never thought that. I think the fact that we have mutually assured destruction means that they are as they are a non-deployable military resource, and I think the people who are in charge of them on both sides of the equation understand that, which is why I think it is a vast waste of money that not only is irrelevant in it to military strategy, but it actually leads to the depletion of military spending elsewhere and having a properly serviced and functioning armed service.
Yeah, and a lot of people would agree with you on that and in your opposition to nuclear weapons, especially on a spending basis. Mm. However, opponents of that argument would say that you need to root policy in reality rather than what we'd like the world to be like. So in the reality of Putin having nuclear weapons and Russia and other hostile states having nuclear weapons, you think us having nuclear weapons makes us less safe or doesn't in fact make us more safe?
I think it makes us less safe, arguably. I think it makes the world a much more dangerous place. And I think if we...
Why is that? Why do you think us having nuclear weapons makes us less safe against Russia?
Because it makes us a nuclear target. And if we're in and it admits the possibility that there could be a nuclear conflict which would lead to such devastating losses on amongst all combatants that it would be extremely devastating for the whole of humanity. I mean, it may well be an existential moment for the human race. And there comes a time. I mean, what worries me is that when I was younger, there was at least a narrative where people talked about the need for disarmament, and the argument was between whether you do that on a multilateral basis or a unilateral basis. And I always believed that you lead by example and take action first. But even people who were against that position were actively trying to pursue, through political and diplomatic means, talks that would lead to a steady reduction of the level of nuclear weapons that we had in the world. And that seems to have gone now. I mean, it's like, you know, it's just crazy that we appear to have major military powers in the world who are committed to increasing the level of nuclear deployment that they're capable of, even though they already have enough to destroy the world many times over. I mean, it's like, you know, it is mesmerizing and bizarre, to be honest. But I do wish at the very least that we could get the dialogue back to talking about the need for mutual disarmament and for reducing nuclear stockpiles and committing, for example, to a no first use policy. And I don't see any prospect of this current government in the United Kingdom taking a lead in those types of talks. But I do see a small independent country like Scotland or Norway or Denmark or whatever being able to cut through and begin to provide some leadership in that if we had the potential to do so, which is, again, you know, for me, political independence is about having agency, about having the power to be able to do stuff beyond your borders to influence the world in which you're living.
Yeah. Okay. So let's talk about independence. You said at the start of the interview that it's a cause that's very close to your heart. So it's not just a, you know, a logical argument for you. It's an emotional argument. Why is that?
Well, I guess, so I've always been inspired by the view that people should be allowed to control their own lives and that political power ought to be exercised at a level that's closest to the people it affects as possible. So that's always been an overriding principle for me. And that's why I believe in universal suffrage. It's why I believe in extending the franchise. It's why I believe in having a fair voting system where the people elected reflect the votes cast. And it's why I always believed in devolution and decentralization within the United Kingdom. I suppose after spending 20 years in the Labour Party advocating for devolution, it was in the noughties, really, under the Blair government, that I became very frustrated about the constraints that devolution represented, as well as the limited opportunities it provided. And I became pretty convinced that if I wanted to change the world in the sort of social democratic, liberal democratic manner, which I always have done, it would be easier to do that if we had the political agency to do that in a small Northern European country like Scotland, where there was a general level of awareness and support for those principles in the population, rather than for Scotland to remain a part of, an adjunct to, a much, much bigger country desperately trying to get to grips with its post-imperial character, and where the attitudes and history and culture mitigate against the type of change I wanted to see. So it became not a change in objective, just a change in means and tactics, really. That's why I became committed to the idea of political independence. But I have to also qualify that by saying that, you know, nobody, except perhaps North Korea, I don't know, no country is completely independent. You know, independence brings with it the obligation and responsibility to work with others. Independence brings with it the obligation and responsibility to work with other countries. All and with knobs on in the British context, where, you know, we share an island, we share a lot of common history and culture and language, and we have very close friends and family links. And of course, a Scottish government would want to work, you know, hand in hand with the governments of England and Wales to do stuff that needs to be done on an island-wide basis, if you like. So I've always regarded an independent Scotland as giving us the opportunity to actually integrate ourselves and communicate and work much better with other people in other countries than, as it's sometimes caricatured, a process of separating yourself and isolating yourself from others.
Yeah, well, on that note of kind of cooperating with other parts of the United Kingdom, as well as other countries further afield, of course, I've spoken to a number of politicians in this kind of interview series from different political parties. And a common theme in what they've said about Scottish politics and British politics is the kind of decline of the tone of politics in recent years. And different people to me have attributed that decline partly to the 2014 referendum in Scottish in a Scottish political context, at least, saying that on both sides there was quite a lot of nastiness in that campaign, and people level to the SNP and to Yes supporters that their whole campaign and their, you know, your whole impetus is an anti-English feeling. How do you get over that, and how do you make sure that if another referendum does come around, you ensure that the campaign doesn't become nasty and becomes about the issues rather than, you know, opposition to the rest of the UK?
Ollie, I know people have said that and I've heard them say it, but I genuinely, that wasn't my experience of the 2012-2014 campaign. I mean, I'm sure there were, you know, every side's got its nutters and the fringes of this thing. The SNP is no exception to that. But the vast majority of people who were engaged in the Yes campaign were, first of all, a lot of very ordinary people who hadn't been involved much politically before. I mean, it did, all the evidence shows that it energized and reached a lot of people who weren't involved in previous political campaigning. And the, if you like, the demographics of those involved in the campaign were very much equal in terms of men and women. They were very much skewed towards younger people who were seemed to be more enthusiastic than older, you know, and they crossed a number of political parties, you know, and they also, I mean, there were, and there still are, a lot of English-born people who live in Edinburgh and who live in Scotland, who were extremely supportive of the Yes campaign and still are. So, and I don't, I mean, I, you know, the campaign I was involved in was an extremely positive one. It sort of, it was all about imagining what independence might mean, you know, because once you say you'll have the power to change things, it immediately raises the question, well, change in what direction? What would this look like? And people engaged in various campaign groups or workplaces or communities all began to ask themselves, well, how could we do this differently? What would it be like? And that was a very positive, life-affirming campaign. I thought I this in the main. The only incident I think was somebody threw eggs at Jim Murphy. I mean, two eggs landed on Jim Murphy once in a 2-year campaign. I mean, that's not really enough to say that the character of this campaign was nasty or divisive or whatever. I accept though that. You know, that on all sides of politics, and I would admit that I've learned this probably over the years, I think it's always important to stand in somebody else's shoes. It's always important to see, not just to believe in something, but to ask yourself, well, how would somebody who doesn't believe in this hear this? What are they hearing me saying? I understand that, and I understand that a lot of people who live in Scotland are very, very attached to their British identity, perhaps very attached if they were born in England to a notion of Englishness, and it is vital, I think, that the campaign for Scottish independence makes it explicit that it is far from being about being anti-English, it's actually about, you know, allowing English people to be fully energized and active in a new Scotland, and about allowing that new Scotland to have the best of relationships with England. In many ways, the union sort of constrains and submerges a lot of differences between people north and south of the border. I mean, I always thought, for example, there's two types of people on either side of this that you can find. One is the surly independence supporter who believes that England's responsible for all of Scotland's woes, right? Which isn't true. We brought a lot of it upon ourselves, to be honest. And then the other is, you know, you'll find these Tory supporters in the Shires in southern England who genuinely believe that that you know, Scotland is being subsidised by England and we've got a better standard of living because they pay for it through their taxes. Independence will give the lie to both of those arguments. No, independence will show, will mean you've got nowhere left to run to, nowhere to hide if you get things wrong, and you have to learn how to organise your own affairs and be accountable for it in Scotland. But it will also show that Scotland is a very wealthy country with a lot of natural resources, and if they were marshalled correctly, it could provide for its communities in much better than it is at the moment without any subsidy from the people who write the letters in green ink or file posts on the Telegraph website.
Mm-hmm. And it's interesting that you speak about resources being used correctly, and you said that independence in part for you is about imagining what could be, how things could be better. But what's always struck me about this debate is that people on the Yes campaign, the SNP, obviously were opponents of Brexit. You were firm supporters of the Remain campaign. And a lot of that opposition was grounded in risk, this unknown. And it was an effective campaign line from the Remain campaign. There weren't too many of them, but it was effective. This line of, well, we don't know what happens if we leave the EU. There's risk. It's unknown. And it seems that that same line can then be turned on its head and directed at the Yes campaign by saying, because a lot of what you've been saying and a lot of what Nicola Sturgeon says is it will be in our control, yes, but we can't guarantee anything. We can't guarantee our prosperity. We can't guarantee X, Y, Z. And so how do you kind of square that circle?
Well, no, you can't guarantee. And the yeah. the other caveat, of course, is what I'm arguing for is that people should be in control of their own lives.
Yeah.
Those people down the line might not agree with running things the way I want them run. Okay, you know, it is entirely, I think it's unlikely in the short term, but it's entirely possible that Scotland might well have a right of centre government that would introduce a range of social and economic policies I would find extremely distasteful. But that is democracy, that people get the chance to vote for that and to have that if that's what they want.
Yeah, and that was the exact argument of the Leave campaign in some ways in 2016.
Yeah, but I think I can answer your question better by giving you some examples, okay? Because, I think the devolved government in Scotland has done a lot of good things, and there are things that you can point to where it's been an improvement. But I think we have to remember also that it is heavily constrained, and there are a lot of things that I'd like to see done in Scotland that simply are beyond the competence of the devolved government. Let me give you some examples. Very contemporary at the minute, right? I mean, next month, every basic rate taxpayer in the United Kingdom, including Scotland, is going to get a tax increase, okay? And my argument is, I'm not against people paying taxes if you can afford them, but taxes are going up for ordinary people because the rate of tax for the best off in our society, the wealthiest, is historically at an all-time low level, lower than it was under Margaret Thatcher, for example. And to protect those low tax rates for the rich and the super rich, ordinary people have to pay more at this point of economic crisis. Now, that's an intensely political decision. I would take that decision differently. I would have a wealth tax on people who've got accumulated wealth, not just income. And I would also have a higher rate of tax for those who earn more. Now, Scotland has got very limited powers over income taxation and no tax raising powers over wealth whatsoever. So in order to do that, to have the panoply of choices that normal independent governments would have, you need to have independence, or you need to have an awful lot more delegated authority, which takes you pretty close to independence. Let me give you another example, the energy crisis, and you know, the fact that Scotland is blessed with a huge amount of the known renewable resources for electricity generation, particularly marine related resources. Now, at the moment, those resources are owned by private corporations. And I firmly believe that there's a case to be made for having a state-owned energy production company, not just supply, an energy production company that takes a stake in those resources so that they can be deployed for the benefit of everyone who lives here rather than benefit the people, you know, the global rich who own the wealthy corporations. Now, but that's not an even... Scottish government can't consider that at the minute. It's simply beyond their powers, and they wouldn't have the access to the necessary capital to be able to borrow and invest in such a strategy. So these are practical things where how we are governed determines the choices we are allowed to make, and where an independent government gives you much greater agency, much greater ability to make different choices. And now, and I do think if we're going to, you know, win the argument next time round, it needs to be deployed in that way. I'm not going to say vote yes in the world, you know, the sunlit uplands suddenly appear and the world is rosy and, you know, we'll all have honey for tea. And then it's rubbish. It's going to be quite challenging, actually, and it will be quite hard along the way, and it won't be easy.
Yeah, but it
will be worth it.
But the basis on which you and many others opposed the Leave campaign in 2016 was that they talked about outcomes and they talked about how they would like things to be and all these policies. And some of the policies you just talked about, many people will think are absolutely fantastic and sound highly desirable. But the problem is the SNP is often accused of ignoring the detail, ignoring the how and what of how do we get there and what will the currency be and what will our exact trade relations be and what will the nature of the border be. Do you accept that sometimes the SNP and others ignore the kind of technicalities of the debate, which people do worry about for the future of their families and their prosperity?
Yeah. Well, but look, I think it's very important to distinguish. There's a big difference between what you say in a referendum campaign, which is about whether or not you have the powers of independence in the first place, and what you might say, for example, in an election campaign in an independent country, because I keep saying that independence is about having the right to choose from different options. I'm not going to argue, for example, that if you vote yes in the next referendum, Scotland will have a wealth tax. Right? For one thing, I don't even think I've won that argument inside my own party, never mind anything else. Right? I'm not arguing that will naturally follow. What I am arguing is that you would have the authority and the competence and the agency and the power to be able to do it if you wanted to. And that, I think that's how the argument needs to be deployed. Not as saying this is what life is going to be like, but these are the levers of power that independence gives you access to. And by the way, one of the biggest ones, I think, in this argument is going to be about Scotland's position in the world. Because at the minute, even though clearly a majority of people in Scotland are quite relaxed and quite empathetic towards the notion of being a European citizen and would like to regard themselves as European, we're denied that option because we're part of a much bigger nation state. If we were our own nation state, suddenly that option opens up again. So I say also that perhaps, and some people will find this paradoxical, but actually removing yourself from the United Kingdom and taking the normal political agency of an independent country allows you to integrate yourself much more into the international system of world affairs.
Sure. And just finally on this conversation, you do think that an independence referendum is likely to happen in this parliament?
Yes, I do. I'd go further than that. I think it has to happen. I think right. This has actually gone beyond, irrespective of what Nicola Sturgeon or myself think. I think having gone to the electorate last May and having had a record turnout at that election and the question of second referendum having been so central to that campaign and people then electing a majority government on a proportional system committed to having that, I think it's a democratic problem if it doesn't then happen. I think, you know, because you would essentially be arguing that the decisions of that election should be set aside. And that doesn't sit well with me in terms of the health of our democracy. So I'm convinced it will happen and it should happen. The big question, of course, is, you know, it doesn't necessarily mean that it could achieve independence, because to do that, you would need the prior consent of the British government to say, okay, we'll accept whatever result comes about. And yes, we could have a referendum, and yes, we could get a yes vote, and Boris Johnson could still say he's going to ignore it. But you then move into different political territory. You then move away from this whole notion of a union by consent or whatever, and you do look at a situation where, you know, Westminster is trying to govern Scotland, actively trying to ignore and override the wishes of the people who live here. And I don't think, and I know a lot of Tory MPs who wouldn't stand for that, by the way. So it's going, that would create an even bigger democratic crisis at a UK level were that to happen. So the sensible thing, the best possible outcome would be to have a rerun of the process that happened in 2012 when Cameron and Salmond met. And agreed, look, okay, well, if this is going to happen, let's make sure it's done in a fair way and blah, blah, blah. And we all understand what happens as a result of it. And I still hope that we can get to that situation with the UK government. But being unable to get that agreement mean that we therefore veto the wishes of the Scottish people who say they want to have a look at this again.
So just very briefly, just suggesting that if that agreement doesn't happen, the referendum should happen regardless.
Yes, and I'm confident that the Scottish Parliament will be able to pass legislation that its civil servants would draft within its competence that will allow what will effectively be a consultative referendum to take place on how people think they should have governed in the future. And if Johnson or anybody else ignores the results of that, I think they will do so at their peril.
Fascinating, thank you. If we may just very briefly turn to Edinburgh, sure. Something that's very much affecting students' lives at the moment are strikes. I had about 2.5 weeks of no class a few weeks ago because the University College Union were striking on quite a big scale. I'm also aware that further strikes being planned for later this month. I know that you joined some staff on the picket line earlier this month. Why was that? Why do you support these strikes?
Well, because I think it's about more than pensions and paying conditions. I think what's been happening since I was a student has been a gradual process of casualization of higher education, where it used, being an academic in higher education used to be regarded as quite a serious position in society, and one that had a lot of respect and kudos, as well as secure employment with it. And I think that led to a much better quality of education for those students who were moving through that system. And I think this constant move to take people off contract, to put them in short-term contracts, to put them on part-time working, to reduce pay, to reduce conditions, that seems to me inevitably it is going to lead to a worse quality of education. And a lot of this has been cloaked by COVID because people have went online or whatever. But I mean, I think if the online element were removed, you would see something of a crisis in the quality of higher education has developed under the radar during COVID. And so I support the UCU campaign, partly because it's time to call a halt to that process. It really is. And you don't have to, you just look around the city and Edinburgh University is everywhere in the city. It must be by far the biggest landowner and wealthiest institution that there is. And nearly all of that money, the vast majority of that money has been accumulated over the decades from the public purse. So it ought to be doing much more to ensure that quality is protected. And, so I would hope that, I'm not privy to the discussions that your principal has with others, but I would like to think that Peter Matheson and others would be arguing for a rethink in how they treat their staff and trying to re-professionalise. It's ironic that we're having a debate about trying to professionalise the care sector and understanding just how bad it is because of the way staff are treated and paid there. And yet we're not stopping that process happening in what used to be the jewel of Edinburgh's crown.
And just finally, do you think there's any kind of influence you can exert as the local MP on Peter Matheson and senior university staff to try and budge on the issue?
I wouldn't expect Peter to do what I call him to do, but I would be one of many voices that I hope he will gauge the the balance of feeling in this. But I mean, I'm supporting this campaign, not, as I say, just because of the lecturers that are involved, but because of the wider impact this has for the city and for the people that I represent. So I hope you might take some cognizance of that. But we as MPs, of course, this is a UK matter, the lecturers' pay and conditions. So we are pressing at Westminster as well to get a better rethinking. I mean, it is ironic that the trustees of the pension fund came out with a report that said the union proposals were good and they should be implemented. And yet the employers decided to reject the advice of the trustees of the pension fund. That is pretty nuts in my view.
Yeah, it's a strange situation and one that is affecting us all. It's been great to hear your opinion on that and all the other issues. Thank you so much for joining us, Tommy. It's been very, very generous of you. Tommy Shepherd, MP. Thank you.
Pleasure.